Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. After Texas House Bill 2 passed 3 years ago, the number of clinics where women could obtain a safe abortion in the state of Texas went from 44 to just 18. In addition to abortions, the clinics that closed also provided contraception, breast exams, cancer screenings, and other health services to mostly low-income and rural Texans. Any day now, we are expecting the Supreme Court to rule on whether HB 2's onerous requirements constitute an undue burden on a woman's right to access an abortion. Several studies show that it does, especially for women of color and low-income women. Clinic closures are forcing women to travel hundreds of miles and spend extra money on things like buses, plane tickets, lodging, and childcare. More than 40% of women who have abortions are poor, according to Fund Texas Choice. And we're seeing this across the country, where anti-choice legislation is passing. So how are women of color organizing and responding to these attacks on reproductive justice? They have been doing it for decades, but a lot of people don't know about that history. Loretta Ross began her career in the women's movement in the 70s. She got her start at the D.C. Rape Crisis Center. She later became the first director of Women of Color Programs at the National Organization for Women. Loretta Ross co-wrote the book Undivided Rights, Women of Color Organize for Reproductive Rights, just re-released by Haymarket Books. It retrieves the often forgotten history of reproductive rights organizations formed by women of color in the 80s and the 90s. Loretta Ross, co-founder of Sister Song, helped coin the term reproductive justice, which represents the full range of organizing for women in their communities to have greater control of all aspects of their reproductive health and lives, beyond access to just abortion and birth control. Hi, Loretta. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thank you for having me on your show.
Well, it's great to have you back. We are also joined by Melanie Renee Garza. Melanie works on volunteer trainings and public policy at Access Women's Health Justice, a reproductive justice organization in the East Bay. Access runs a statewide reproductive hotline, which connects women who experience barriers to services to a network of volunteers. And sometimes they get financial help. Sometimes they just need a couch on which to spend the night before they have an abortion. And we'll talk about those services later in the show. And Melanie joins us on the line from Oakland. Hi, Melanie. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Good morning. Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. So, Loretta, I want to start off with you because we are eagerly awaiting this Supreme Court decision, one of the most important decisions since Roe v. Wade, and it's expected to come down any day now. And can you just talk about the importance of this decision and specifically how it affects and will affect women of color?
Well, the Supreme Court, unfortunately, has the power to decide whether a woman can actually exercise her human rights to control her own body. Because by limiting abortion access, they're basically saying that women don't have the right to determine whether or not they will continue a pregnancy to term or not. So the court could certainly support women's human rights and abortion access, or it could deny them. And I think that that is such an unfortunate circumstance because women, when they become pregnant, are no less deserving of human rights. They should have the same rights to control their body and bodily autonomy than any other human being has. But we've been boxed into this situation where what we do with our bodies is determined legislatively, when really it isn't the business of a legislature or a judicial system to tell us whether or not we're ready to become a mother.
We've done several shows about the documentary Trapped, which was made by Dawn Porter. She's been on the show a few times, about how these laws are affecting women across the country. And that documentary is going to air tonight on PBS at 10 o'clock. I hope you can all see it. It's an incredible documentary. And Loretta, in the film, the one thing that really gets me and I still think about is when Dawn interviewed Marva Sadler. She's director of clinical services for Whole Women's Health in San Antonio. And she got a call about a 13-year-old rape victim who was 20 weeks pregnant. Because of all of these onerous laws, it's really hard for the clinics in Texas to find nurses. And she had to put this young girl to sleep in order to have the procedure. But she couldn't find the nurse. And so she feels like this girl probably was forced to have this baby at age 13. She basically said, we're sentencing people to motherhood. And Dawn found in her travels that these sentences to motherhood specifically affect poor women and people of color, because women with means could spend about, you know, $5,000 to fly out of state, and that's currently what's happening. Can you talk about that also?
Well, I relate to that story because at 14, I became pregnant through incest also in the state of Texas. But this was in the 1960s when abortion was not available. And at the time, I only had the choice of whether to have the baby. I didn't have the choice of whether to have the baby, but whether to keep my child. And I made the decision to keep my son. But that meant for the last 47 years, I've been tethered to my rapist as a co-parent. And so that continued the violation. So I have lived the experience of that 13-year-old rape victim. Mm. And so I offer my actual experience against those who just say, oh, well, if you've been raped, you know, you should just have the baby and keep it, or all those kinds of things, because they only are talking theoretically. But I know, despite how much I love my son, that he had a compromised childhood because I loved him, but I hated his circumstances. And I really despise having to stay in conversation with a 27-year-old man who raped me when I was 14. And so these situations are still going on. I had to escort a 12-year-old who came to Georgia from Chicago because we provide abortions up to 24 weeks and Chicago, Illinois didn't. And she was still sucking her thumb at the same time she had to come for a 21-week abortion. And she shouldn't have to come from out of state. We had to raise the money to fly her in, put her in a hotel. Her mother had to come. Her mother with the baby had to come. I mean, the contortions that they're forcing women to go through to protect not only themselves but our children is ridiculous. It's inhumane. And it is alarmingly callous, because no one's looking at the reality. If we cannot protect our children, why are we punishing them for our inability to protect them from childhood sexual abuse?
Loretta, if you go to clinics across the country, you will hear these stories. And Dawn Porter said she was surprised when she went to these clinics and learned so many cases of incest and rape, especially when you're talking about 13-year-olds, 15-year-olds. And we don't really talk about that in society. How can we focus on these issues that, frankly, a lot of people would rather not talk about? I mean, when you think about the presidential debates, abortion has barely even come up, let alone talking about incest and rape of young girls.
Well, we really have to keep forcing the conversation, telling our stories. That's why I share my story on your radio show, so that we can see that these are not abstractions, but real people with real lives, with real hard decisions to make. But at the same time, I want to back up. And I believe that one of the reasons we have so much difficulty stopping childhood sexual abuse, stopping rape, stopping prohibiting women from controlling their bodies, is that as a country, we're uncomfortable with the coupling of conversations around women and sexuality, that we should be protecting children from predators. But at the same time, young people have a human right to express their own sexuality in age-appropriate ways. But we're so deeply uncomfortable, not only with all women having sex, but particularly young women having sex and young people having sex, that we really throw our skirts over our heads and we run from the conversations, and we end up with all these pious moral, you know, justifications for actually neglecting our children instead of protecting them and encouraging them through healthy, evidence-based sex education, through providing school-based health clinics where they can get access to contraceptives and information, by providing untrammeled abortion options if an unplanned pregnancy takes place. I mean, we're doing such a poor job. And when you compare it to what's happening in those countries where they do promote sex education and contraceptive and abortion access, you see a lower teen pregnancy rate, a lower STD rate, a lower child abuse rate. It's kind of like guns. We are so schizophrenic over these kinds of conversations as a country.
And Loretta, that's what really comes out in this book, Undivided Rights, Women of Color Organize for Reproductive Justice. You are one of the co-authors with a number of other women who are very active in this, on these issues. And the main point that you're all making is that this is about so much more than choice. A lot of the more mainstream groups focus on pro-choice, pro-choice. But as you just laid out, there's so many more issues that are directly connected to choice and that need to get a lot more attention from some of these mainstream groups.
Well, we wrote Undivided Rights starting in 1999, and it was published originally in 2004 and reissued in 2016. And my co-authors are Marlene Gerber-Fried, Yael Silliman, and Elena Gutierrez. We wrote that because at the time, there was the belief that women of color weren't working on reproductive health rights and justice issues, that somehow we needed the white community to come in and save us, when in fact we were doing a lot of work on these issues at ourselves, but we were poised facing distrust from communities of color who didn't want to talk about those issues, and from the mainstream movement that's predominantly white that didn't think we were sufficiently feminist enough because we didn't only work on abortion. And many women of color have a very complicated relationship to the abortion rights movement. Matter of fact, many women of color would define themselves as pro-life, but they do so in a way that says, well, basically, I wouldn't have an abortion, but I'm not going to stop somebody else from doing so. Well, the feminist movement kind of dismisses people like that. And so when we wrote Undivided Rights, the title says all our human rights should be undivided. You shouldn't have to choose between feeding your child and freedom of speech. We should have intersectional undivided rights. But we also wanted to showcase the hundreds of women of color who were doing the work in our community. So we chose 8 case studies, Native American, African American, Latina, and Asian Pacific Islander, to show how women all over the country in many different ways were working on reproductive health rights and justice issues. And then in 1994, actually a decade before the book was published, the framework of reproductive justice was created. And so we found in our research of our case studies that women of color particularly were moving towards a new paradigm called reproductive justice that really has gone on and transformed the entire pro-choice movement, in my opinion, moving from the margins to the center. I don't know if you want me to talk about what is reproductive justice now, or should I make it for a separate question?
Sure, no, please do it now.
Well, reproductive justice was created by 12 black women. We were at a conference in Chicago in 1994. I was lucky to be one of them. And we were problematizing the Clintons' attempt to first reform health care reform. And what struck us was that we were told that they were going to try to omit any reference to reproductive health care as a way of kind of sliding it by the Republican opposition. And we thought that strategy simply did not make sense. Unfortunately for us, the Republicans are not that dumb and they're not asleep. And so they weren't going to slide it by the Republicans. But what they were doing was basically creating a male-centered health care plan that really threw women under the bus, because the number one reason a woman first goes to the doctor is for reproductive health care, you know, if all else is okay. And so when you fail to include reproductive health care and health care reform, you're basically saying we're not centering women in this lens. We're going to just try to get a political compromise that looks good but really disadvantages women. And so we 12 Black women purchased a signature ad in the Washington Post. And what we decided that abortion rights was severed from social justice issues, because before a woman decides to continue a pregnancy, she's going to worry about whether she has a job, whether she has health care, whether she's experiencing violence at home, will the child have a place to go to a quality school, all of these things. And so when you only talk about abortion, you're really not paying attention to how all women actually make decisions about parenthood. And so we spliced together the concept of reproductive rights with social justice, created the term reproductive justice, and made that our organizing cry. We purchased that ad in the Washington Post in 1994. 835 Black women joined us to demand that reproductive health care be included in health care reform. And then Sister Song, my former organization, decided to use reproductive justice as its organizing platform at its first national conference in 2003. And so we can probably date that as the launch of the Women of Color movement that, as I said, marched from the margins to the center. So you end up with even the mainstream organizations like Planned Parenthood and the Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice and NARAL, all these organizations now claiming the title of being reproductive justice organizations, which is a bit amusing and a bit misleading, because reproductive justice basically says you have to fight for the right to not have a child, which joins us with the pro-choice movement, but you also have to fight for the right to resist population control and have the children that you want to have. And that is a particular type of reproductive oppression visited on women of color when we are dissuaded from having the children that we want to have. And then the third tenet is the right to raise our children in safe and healthy environments. And so that brings us into conversation, for example, with the Black Lives Matter movement, with environmental justice, with gentrification struggles, with anti-police brutality, anti-racism, charter schools. I mean, there's not an area of human endeavor that reproductive justice can interrogate, because we're talking about why our country needs bodies for labor and capitalism and military and all of that stuff. But they also decide whose bodies are valued and whose bodies and children are devalued. And so we look at everything through a reproductive justice lens. So it goes way beyond just talking about abortion, which kind of confuses people. Mm. So the short answer is the right to have a child, the right not to have a child, the right to parent your children. That's reproductive justice. Simply said, but it is a capacious concept that interrogates everything about how a nation deals with this population, whether it's immigration, the prison industrial complex, all of those things.
Loretta Ross began her career in the women's movement in the 1970s. She got her start at the D.C. Rape Crisis Center. She's co-founder of Sister Song, and she co-wrote the book Undivided Rights, Women of Color Organized for Reproductive Rights. It was first published in 2004, and there is a second edition out now, and there is a new preface to this second edition. Find more information at yourcallradio.org. Loretta Ross is joining us from Albany, New York, and Melanie Renee Garza is joining us from Oakland. Melanie works on volunteer trainings and public policy at Access Women's Health Justice. They run a statewide reproductive hotline connecting women who experience barriers to services to a network of volunteers. And Melanie, as you're talking about this incredible history from Loretta and hearing about these Black women who got together to coin the term reproductive justice and then place this ad in the Washington Post, what really goes through your mind, and how do you at Access think about what reproductive justice actually means?
So I think for me personally, I came into access with my own experiences as a woman of color experiencing barriers and these sort of different systemic oppressions. So that's where I go back to when I think about reproductive justice is my own, I guess my own experience in it before I knew that it was called reproductive justice. And so as I'm listening to Loretta, I'm thinking, you know, this is amazing to, one, be listening to someone who has contributed so much, you know, and developed this framework for us to understand our oppression and to also understand our resistance to that. You know, and I think about the callers that we talk to on a daily basis, and, you know, they're naming exactly what support they need and what's not working out for them in their lives. And like Loretta mentioned, a lot of them, you know, they do want to be able to parent. A lot of them are already parents, but there are things in place that definitely prevent them from doing that in a way that they feel okay doing so. So I think back to them and how we are having these conversations addressing our reproductive oppression and these injustices without really naming them. And I think that just kind of uplifting them in their experiences and also uplifting their stories when, you know, they give us the permission to share their stories is really important in sharing this kind of information with folks who don't really know what reproductive justice is or who, you know, think they know but are really only talking about pro-choice. So there's a lot more, yeah, that goes into it.
And we often talk about Texas for obvious reasons because HB2 is one of the most extreme anti-abortion laws that we have seen. And then the clinics in Texas have just shut down, again, going from 44 to 18. And while we have had pro-choice legislation pass in California, one of the only states in the country, there are still a lot of barriers, especially for poor women, women of color, women who live in, you know, small towns, rural California. And a lot of people don't know about that, Melanie. So can you tell us about some of the barriers that women in California are facing?
Yeah, definitely. So I can also speak to my own experience just for the sake of not, you know, throwing our callers under the bus completely. I grew up in the Central Valley, and there isn't a lot of reproductive health care services out there. It's either very limited in one city, to one city, or, you know, the largest, like, metropolitan area has restrictions on how far they go, how long they perform abortions, or, you know, there's, like, waiting periods for even accessing birth control. So I think a good example that I like to share with folks when they're asking about what it's like in the Central Valley is there are things that are kind of already in play out there that affect how callers can get to their appointments. So, for example, growing up in an area where there isn't a lot of public transportation and you have to have a car definitely presents challenges when you're trying to travel to the city that's like 30 miles over. Who also only goes up to 13 weeks to perform abortions. And then, you know, here comes, like, the environmental factors into that. You know, where I grew up, a lot of people have asthma or, you know, other respiratory issues because the air quality is so bad in the valley. Mm-hmm. So we have folks who, you know, maybe they do have the means to travel 30 miles to get to the next clinic, and they're under 13 weeks to get their abortion, but they have asthma. So then there's clinics out there that will not accept patients with, like, quote, high risk, so asthma being one of them. Therefore, this person, you know, is no longer eligible to receive services at that clinic. The next clinic is maybe in San Francisco, so they now have to travel 200 miles, you know, 300 miles, a five-hour train ride to San Francisco to get their abortion. So I think that the landscape in Northern California is very different, but it, you know, it all comes back to the same sort of barriers that the callers face. It's, there aren't a lot of resources in these areas already for folks of color and for folks who are living at a poverty level, you know, and who are already parenting and maybe are in a single-parent household.
And that is Melanie Renee Garza. She works on volunteer trainings at Access Women's Health Justice. And when she talks about callers, she's referring to their statewide hotline. It connects women who experience barriers to services with a network of volunteers. So some people might need a place to stay for the night. Some people might need financial assistance. So people call into Access to get that help. We're also joined today by Loretta Ross. She is a longtime activist. She began her career in the women's movement in the 70s. She's co-founder of Sister Song, co-wrote the book Undivided Rights, Women of Color Organize for Reproductive Rights. And today we are talking about how women of color have organized and continue to organize around these issues. Again, we are expecting a Supreme Court decision any day now on Texas House Bill 2. It will determine whether or not clinics can continue to shut down across the country. And I hope you can check out the documentary Trapped, which looks at these trap laws, tonight on PBS at 10 o'clock. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on 91.7 KALW San Francisco. To take part in today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Toll free. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear from new voices. Or if you'd prefer to write rather than call, you may email us to feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. Coming up in a half hour, it's Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting, reactions to the shootings in Orlando a week ago. That's at 11 o'clock, half hour from now here on KLW San Francisco.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation about how the Bay Area Native American tribe, Amam Mutsin, is using traditional knowledge to solve today's environmental problems. How are Native American traditions and knowledge helping to restore California's ecosystem? That's tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join us today, we'd love to hear from you. What does reproductive justice mean to you? If you've been in this movement for a couple of decades, what are your thoughts about how the language has changed or not changed over the years? If you work on reproductive health and rights issues and you'd like to talk about some organizing stories, your experiences in the movement, especially when it comes to working with low-income women and people of color, give us a call, 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are joined by Loretta Ross. She is co-author of the book Undivided Rights, Women of Color Organize for Reproductive Rights. It first came out in 2004, and there is now a second edition out with a new preface. We're also joined by Melanie Renee Garza. She works on volunteer trainings with Access. They run a statewide reproductive hotline connecting women with a network of volunteers. And Loretta, whenever I go to, you know, rallies to interview people or do shows about this, it's always so interesting to talk with activists who've been working on these issues for decades and then younger activists. And I just always love to ask, you know, people like you, women like you, how are you putting all of this into context? And when you, you know, when you go to bed at night and you think about these issues, what really runs through your mind? Because it's at this point, it's really hard to keep up with all of the bills that are passing.
Well, I don't have any problem putting it in context because I wasn't dealt another life to live. And so whenever I think I'm too tired, I'm too burnt out, I think about my son, my grandchildren, and what kind of world I want to leave them. And so I'm never actually too tired, no matter how many times I wish we weren't still fighting the same battle for reproductive justice over and over and over again. I mean, we're in the 21st century. fighting the values and the holdovers from the 19th century. I mean, when you couple that with the resurgence of white supremacy through the Trumpetistas and the environmental destruction and the prison industrial complex, I mean, I actually have to quote Lily Tomlin. She said, no matter how cynical you become, you can't keep up. You know, because you really just can't. But at the same time, I am terribly re-energized by young people. Mm. I love the fact that the younger movement to end violence against women gave us the gift of talking about rape culture and mansplaining and naming things that we didn't know how to name. Whenever somebody names something, a new power enters the world, kind of like with reproductive justice. And so they are tremendously energizing for me. And sometimes I get tired, particularly when I have to go against people who are just being hypocrites. Because one of the things we can't do, those of us who work at clinics and reproductive health centers, is violate privacy to show that the same people protesting are often our clients, or their daughters are our clients.
Right.
So they come to get the services that they would deny to others. But we're never going to violate their privacy to say that, and they know that. And so their hypocrisy is a bit astonishing. And then they do all kinds of bizarre things. I was talking to someone else about a white family who's using assisted reproductive technology to get implanted with all these black embryos so that they could raise black children and show that, you know, you don't have to have an abortion, that they are, you know, true warriors for justice by choosing to, I guess, birth their own slaves. I'm not quite sure what they're doing.
Where is this happening?
There's a white couple that has made national newspapers where they are choosing to be implanted with black embryos as part of their Christian duty to show that abortion is wrong, and they're proving their anti-racist credentials by using these children kind of like as their laboratory experiment and their testament to how anti-racist they are. Oh, my God. All these perversions are taking place. And I'm not saying, you know, mixed race families are perverted. I'm saying that children should be treasured for who they are, not what political symbolism they represent in your life. And when I go to our demonstrations and you see so many white people thrust their black adopted children in our faces and say, you know, we saved this child and all of that, I'm like, you know, I can't even save what you deserve because that child already is going to have a hard life being raised by a racist parent. Mm. So I can't even respond to you like I want to. Yeah. But it's a very complicated world. I love doing social justice work,
though. Well, we're glad you're not tired, Loretta. The story you were just talking about, in case anybody wants to read about this, now I remember, this guy, Aaron Halbert, is the father of these babies, and he is a missionary serving in Honduras. He wrote a story about why they did this. My wife and I are white evangelicals. Here's why we chose to give birth to black triplets, is in the Washington Post if you want to read more about this. I mean, Loretta, you're dealing with this. You've dealt with these ads, not even, it was in the last 4 or 5 years, about
the billboards,
exactly. You're dealing with that. And then you have to deal with, and these are billboards that say that, you know, abortion is killing black babies. I wanted to also ask you about how you deal with the ugly past, the racist past. So in the book that you co-authored, Undivided Rights, you all write that during the colonization of the United States, Native American women were intentionally given blankets infected with smallpox. Population control during slavery took the form of brutal and coercive efforts to increase African American women's reproduction, with slave owners using rape and forced marriages to achieve this. However, since then, population control efforts have been intended to prevent women of color from having children. So I wonder how you deal with that in today's world, because there's this program I'm sure you've heard about in Colorado that was privately funded, and it's providing IUDs for teenagers It's a voluntary program. Even groups of color recommend this program. They say that it's been amazing because the birth rate for women in Colorado ages 15 to 19 fell 48% from 2009 to 2014 because these IUDs have been offered for free. So how do you, what are your thoughts on this program given past history?
Well, you cannot understand reproductive politics in this country without understanding white supremacy and settler colonialism. And I know that sounds like big concepts, but the reality is that when it is in the interest of what I guess we could call the 1% to have more workers, then they have policies that produce more workers. But now we're in a neoliberal state where they need fewer workers. And so they're against those things that are about, you know, women having control or workers' rights or, you know, unemployment. Oh, we could talk about the destruction of the social safety net that they no longer see as necessary. But I think it's a bit naive to try to analyze reproductive politics without understanding white supremacy and why they felt the need to wipe out the Native American people who were here in order to settle the country and pretend it was just theirs for the taking. Why black babies were valued during the enslavement and then immediately devalued after the enslavement, why black mothers were assumed to be great mammies for white babies and terrible mothers for their own children, why they accuse people who are immigrants of coming here to have, quote, anchor babies, but they depend on these same immigrants to do all the farm labor, to provide the food, to take care of the babies. I mean, these contradictions can only be explained through white supremacy. But I want to say one particular thing. When you look at the teen pregnancy rates in America for the last 5 years, teen pregnancies have gone down for every group of every ethnic group except one, and that is white teenagers. White teenage teen pregnancy rates are actually going up. And so in a bizarre way, their restrictions on birth control and sex education and abortion are actually working because they're producing more white babies while they are busy killing off all the other babies of color or not wanting them. And so if you don't use the right lens, you really don't understand and can't explain the contradictions between people who say that they're opposed to abortion but are also opposed to birth control and sex education.
Hmm. And have you read much about the program in Colorado? Because, I mean, when you just look at the birth rate falling 48% for women and girls for 15 to 19, those are incredible numbers.
The birth rate is falling, and I do hear from my colleagues in Colorado that they really support the program. But I'm one of those people that's a little skeptical, not because young people don't deserve access to a full range of contraceptive options, but is that being accompanied by a conversation about the right of young people to a healthy sexuality so that they don't feel shame if they're choosing to use a contraceptive or to use a condom to protect themselves through safe sex. I would love to see us talking about being the pro-sex movement, because this is what's underlying all of this stuff, shame and blame around women's sexuality. So, yes, I love what's going on in Colorado. I want more.
And what are your thoughts on this, Melanie? Have you been looking at the program in Colorado?
I'm not as familiar with it, actually.
What are your thoughts about what Loretta just said about pro-sex? We had Peggy Orenstein on about a month ago. She's out with a book about this very topic. I believe it's Girls and Sex. That's what it's called.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the great things about the reproductive justice framework is that it allows for, like, the entirety of our identities to be put forth in sort of an unapologetic way. So I think where there are, like, variances of folks who might, you know, identify or, you know, live as in more of a pro-sex way, like, there's space for that, right? And then if folks, like, you know, feel like that's not necessarily like part of their core. Like, there's space for that too. What I think is that we as a movement do a pretty good job at like making space for all of these like different identities and not, you know, bringing any shame or judgment to the table. So I think no matter which way you go in it, if you're really like, you know, living these values of reproductive justice, there's space for all of that. You know, there's space for folks to be, you know, who they are and bring all of their identities forth without any type of shame. And something that I do want to plug in, though, that I was kind of thinking of when I was hearing Loretta speak about, like, the teen pregnancy and, like, Prosex, is there's a program in place with an organization that Access works with very closely, California Latinas for Reproductive Justice, and they have a really great program for young parents. So it's about, like, uplifting these young parents and their experiences as pregnant and parenting folks. So kind of like making sure that they're receiving, you know, dignity and support in the same way that like adult parents would. And so I think that that is a really good illustration as to how the movement really does make room for folks to make their own decisions about their bodies and how they choose to parent and not parent.
Melanie Renee Garza works on volunteer trainings and public policy at Access Women's Health Justice. They run a reproductive hotline in California connecting women and girls with a network of volunteers. We're also joined by Loretta Ross. She began her career in the women's movement in the 1970s. She worked with the D.C. Rape Crisis Center. She became the first director of Women of Color programs at NOW, co-founder of Sister Song, and she co-wrote the book Undivided Rights, Women of Color Organized for Reproductive Rights. It came out in 2004, and it's just been re-released by Heyday, and there's a new preface in the second edition. And if you'd like to join us, if you have any questions or comments for our guests, if you'd like to talk about reproductive justice and what that means to you, what do you see in terms of organizing with women of color and organizations working with women of color and low-income women? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And we just got an email from Sally reminding everyone to watch the film Trapped on Independent Lens tonight at 10 o'clock. And also, if it's not airing in your area, you can find a number of community screenings on the website trapped.org. And this is an excellent documentary that takes a look at how these laws are affecting women and girls across the country. And we have another question from Lisa. What is the correlation between the economic conditions that many women of color are in that affect their full reproductive freedom? She said, as you said, Loretta, this is a fight that has gone on for centuries. So what are the meta values and concepts that are going to let us stop having to fight for basic control of our bodies?
Well, first of all, before I respond to the question, I want to thank you, Melanie, for sending a shout out to California Latinos for Reproductive Justice. They're under the leadership of Laura Jimenez, and Laura used to work for Sister Song. She was the first national coordinator. So please pass on to her my wonderful support for the excellent work she's doing with CLRJ. Now, the economic conditions are those things that are the meta-narratives that determine the lives of people in any given country. I mean, when we were a settler country that depended on agriculture, we needed lots of workers to farm. And so we had a very pro-natalist need more population policy, as long as the population wasn't Native American. Then when we moved into an industrialized economy, then we needed a specific set of workers. And then again, when women started entering the workforce and stuff, well, in order for women to enter the workforce, they actually had to relax the restrictions on women controlling their own bodies. So we saw the introduction of birth control, the decriminalization of birth control and abortion when we had a worker-based industrialized economy. Now that we've transitioned to a neoliberal economy where most of the industrialized jobs are outsourced to other countries, we the 1% need fewer workers. And so they are now re-racializing who should be encouraged to give birth and who should be discouraged from giving birth. And we're seeing all kinds of interesting incentives, like, since I'm talking to you in Northern California, why should women be offered $20,000 by Silicon Valley corporations to store their eggs for later reproduction, which, by the way, is not even a viable strategy because many of those eggs will not be bought to pregnancy because the technology simply doesn't exist yet. So it's a false promise. But, you know, as a employee benefit, a $20,000 egg storage process. At the same time, we're struggling to feed the children who are already here, who are struggling to educate low-income children in communities of color. And Lord knows we're struggling to keep them from being killed by the police. And so who gets privileged in the cradle competition and who gets disadvantaged is something that any person of moral character and ethics has to pay sharp attention to. And that's what reproductive justice does. It draws attention to those disparities and those inconsistencies between what we say we want and what we actually produce.
Hmm. Also, Loretta, what about how things shift? So during the last election, you would not hear Republican candidates, for example, say that they oppose abortion even in cases of rape and incest. And now they are very comfortable embracing that policy, very extreme policy, right? And now we have these feticide laws that are disproportionately used against women of color. And Purvi Patel's 20-year prison sentence for a miscarriage got quite a lot of attention. She's now appealing the ruling. She was convicted of feticide. And, I mean, this is starting to happen more often lately. So can you also talk about that? And how should groups respond to these laws?
Well, first of all, they have created a concept we call pregnancy policing. And it's not just women of color. Women of color kind of like are the canaries in the coal mine. So we often experience reproductive oppression, the harshest and the first. But we also have to go back to a white woman's case named Angela Carter. Angela Carter was dying of terminal cancer, who was pregnant, and the government and hospital ordered her to have a forced cesarean that killed her in the, you know, hopes of saving her fetus. The baby died too. I mean, and so we have so many instances where the government and medical authorities are intervening immorally in these decisions and not really caring about the fate of the mothers, but so in worshiping and enshrining this so-called fetal life stuff. But I think that is also a ploy, because how can they care so much about the babies before they're born and then not give a damn about them when it comes to paying for child care, health care, education once they're here? Mm. I mean, that contradiction is so palpable. And so I think they use these cultural issues like gay rights, immigration, abortion, birth control, all as part of the cultural war to seek and gain and hold on to power. It is really about the struggle for power of the forces of regression against the forces of modernity. That's the big meta-narrative we need to pay attention to. And I think sometimes we focus so in on the war against women or the war against LGBT folks and all of that stuff and miss the larger narrative that's really about a group of desperate people doing everything to hang on power by manipulating people, manipulating the mainstream media, manipulating facts and all kinds of things, like they make up their own facts even. And we really, that's why reproductive justice is useful, because you can connect those kinds of dots. You can talk about those things in the same conversation and not split the queer rights movement from the immigration rights movement from the women's rights movement, and all build a united human rights movement for justice.
And so what do you think, given what you just said, when you connect all of those dots, what is the most effective response?
I am doing a lot of work right now about trying to transition the calling out culture into a calling in culture. I think we spend too much time criticizing the people we must work with to build a human rights movement because they don't necessarily agree with us on everything. And so I think we weaken ourselves when we don't learn how to call each other in and use our differences as strengths instead of weaknesses. And so that's what I'm focused on now after 50 years doing this social justice work. I think the most important thing we can do is come together across our differences and see these differences as strengths. So I want to be part of the women's rights wing of the human rights movement, working with the anti-racist wing of the human rights movement and the environmental justice wing of the human rights movement. We all can work on different things, but we can work in unity together. That was the mission and message of Sister Song, our Women of Color Reproductive Justice Collective. And that's the work that I think we need to do together. And I'm not saying we use calling in all the time because there's a continuum, because there are people we really do need to call out. But at the same time, they're much fewer than the people that we're using our weaponized consciousness against.
And Loretta, we've got about 30 seconds. Is there a specific group that you have been trying to work with that maybe you did not work with in the past?
Well, I've really put a focus on young people because they're the ones who live naturally intersectionalized lives. And so they get it when they're offered the skills on how to call people in because they don't like being boxed into one social justice issue or one cause. They want to care about a lot of things at the same time. And so I love working with young people on transitioning to a calling in culture.
Loretta Ross co-wrote the book Undivided Rights, Women of Color Organize for Reproductive Rights. A second edition is out now by Heyday Books. Check out Loretta's work at yourcallradio.org. Melanie Renee Garza works with Access Women's Health Justice. They connect women and girls with a network of volunteers. And again, the Supreme Court decision is going to come down any day now that will determine whether or not clinics can continue to shut down across the country. Be sure to watch the documentary Trapped, which looks at these trap laws. It airs tonight on PBS at 10 o'clock. Loretta and Melanie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about how the Bay Area Native American tribe, Amam Mutsun, is using its traditional knowledge to solve today's environmental problems. California Indians have used an array of sophisticated techniques, such as burning, pruning, and weeding, to direct animals and plants' growth and reproduction. So how are Native American traditions and knowledge helping to restore California's ecosystem? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.